Elvin Turner, innovation consultant and author of the best-selling Be Less Zombie, talks to us about innovation strategy and leadership. In this show, he highlights how often leaders feel deeply ill-prepared to lead innovation efforts because so much of their experience is grounded in maintaining the status quo. For a rich set of insights about how to switch on innovation and keep it alight, stay tuned.
You're listening to the Evolving Leader Podcast. I'm Scott Allender, co-host of the show, along with my friend and honestly one of the most forward-thinking minds in leadership and leadership development, Mr. John Gomes.
Oh, God, that's very kind of you, Scott. What's happened to you? No, sorry.
Would you like me to do something punchier instead?
No, that's lovely. Thank you. It's a nice way to start off my Friday afternoon. How are you feeling, Scott?
I'm in a really good place today, actually. I'm feeling quite a bit of optimism at the moment in the sort of direction things are going. Feels like the light at the end of the tunnel has been getting a little bit brighter. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling very warm and fecund.
What does that mean?
Full of possibility, pregnant fecund? With opportunity. Fecund.
Fecund?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to write that down so I can use that later.
Okay. So, no, but it's because we're reconnecting with a really dear old friend and colleague, Elvin Turner. So welcome, Elvin.
I'm delighted to be here. I've been watching this or listening to this podcast with interest for some time, and finally my invite came. So I feel honored to be here today, John.
Well, we felt we had to, get past our teething, stage before we brought you on. We had to get ready for you. So this is all part of the preparation. Now, Elvin, can you give us... can you give our listeners a quick tour of your background, your interests, and the things that you're working on right now?
Yeah, sure. So, for the listeners' benefit, John and I worked together for some time, many years actually, and that's where I got my grounding in innovation, and my interest in innovation started up when we were working at kind of the crosshairs of leadership and change and innovation. And the last few years that John and I worked together, I guess I headed up the innovation practice. And I think that's where everything suddenly clicked for me on what do I actually want to do with my life? What am I really interested in? And it was the space of helping organizations continually pursue relevance and do better in every sort of perspective. So the things that I do now are I help leadership teams figure out innovation strategy. Who do we need to become and why, and what's it going to take to get there? Leadership development, then helping them figure out, well, who do I need to become? What's the next step for me to be able to create an environment where great ideas can show up successfully? And then the third area more and more these days is writing, and just starting my second book, which I'm loving. I'm trying to make more time in my life for writing. So yeah, that's more or less what I do, and a bit of teaching on the side on MBA programs.
Well, let's start with your first book, if we could. You wrote a book called Be Less Zombie, which is a brilliant title in my opinion, because I would have expected the title maybe to be Don't Be a Zombie, but you're not even setting the bar that high. You're saying you can be a little zombie, just be, less zombie. What was the origin of that book? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it started out as a bit of fun, really. I was asked to run a session at Henley Business School on innovation, and we'd been around the loop a few times for a few years on the standard stuff, and I thought, I just want to do something a bit different. So we had the idea of unicorns at one end of the spectrum, organizations that maybe still aren't even making money, but they're hot, they're on a trajectory. What is it that they're doing differently that everybody else isn't doing and managing to succeed? So we thought, what's at the other end of the spectrum? And we thought, well, some kind of being that's lunging forward, trying to find its next meal to stay alive. So we picked zombies. And it was just for fun. And it went down really well amongst all the delegates. So I thought, I wonder if there's something in this. Anyway, it went from there, and you're kind of right about the bar. I'm just trying to be honest. Most organizations are frustrated with their innovation performance. I think I read in a survey recently, 94% of CEOs are dissatisfied with the level of innovation in their organization. So we can all do better. That's not to say everyone is a zombie, but I think if we're really honest, none of us are really at the level of performance that we'd like to be. So it's about shaking off the zombieisms, clearing them out of the closet, and pursuing better.
This might be an overly simplistic question, but what do you think is the most single important factor that determines whether an organization is innovative or not?
Well, it's funny. I ask that question sometimes in seminars, and for me, it's the simplicity of actually choosing to be an innovation giant, if you like, or just choosing what innovation performance state are you going after. Because if we allow the status quo to have its way, we generally find ourselves just running faster after the same things, a little bit more efficiently, perhaps a little bit more effectively, but ultimately we run the risk of failing at the hands of the innovator's dilemma, which is we become so good at what we do, we miss the tide, we miss the wave that overtakes us. And that's a story that you can read about in every industry, where we miss the big change. And every major technology shift in any industry, very rarely do the main players make it across to the next horizon. So when I was writing the book, I wanted to just really see if there was one needle that you needed to move inside the organization that causes everything else to fall into place behind it, what would that be? And for me, it was leaders saying, listen, we've got no choice. If we don't innovate, ultimately the world will catch up with us and we'll die. So why don't we make a virtue out of that, know that most people won't do that, and actually choose a high level of innovation performance, count the cost, and go for it. And it's a deliberate, continuous pursuit of relevance.
So innovation is a broad topic, and I sometimes think, you know, part of the challenge is that when we say the word innovation, different sort of ideas about that come to mind. But I'm really interested in what you said about 94% of CEOs being frustrated as a consistency across all different industry. Can you maybe shine some light on why you think we haven't solved this yet?
Well, it's ironic at some level. So often what happens when I meet an exec for the first time is they'll tell me, you know, there's not enough innovation in our organization. And I say, really, tell me more. It turns out within a couple of minutes, we realize there's no shortage of incremental innovation. It's everywhere because it's just nudging what we do today. There's no real challenge. No one's going to get upset. No one's going to get fired. The real difficulty is when we think about those big ideas that are going to get us into the future, they're going to buy us more competitive advantage, dig us deeper moats of advantage. They're far and few between. And, you know, the story that I tell in the Be Less Zombie is classically the CEO opens the big idea cupboard and there's nothing in there. And that's the frustration. It's not that there's not enough innovation. It's the type of innovation that's lacking. And that's the bigger, the bolder ideas that feel more risky. And if you look at the organizations that have got cupboards that are bulging with these, what they've done is, I mean, they've taken a leaf out of Astro Teller's book from Google X, the moonshot factory, where he talks about pursuing making audacity, the pursuit of audacity, the path of least resistance. So it's not dangerous to challenge the status quo. It's not dangerous to pursue bigger ideas that could actually cannibalize what we do today, because we all know that sooner or later, what we do today will be overtaken by someone else. Might as well be us. So let's set an environment where some of these bolder ideas have a bigger chance of coming forward. So to say there's not we're dissatisfied with innovation, it doesn't really tell the whole story. And I've learned you have to dig a bit deeper. And usually the case is tons of incremental stuff. It's not sufficient. We need bigger ideas.
So what is it the root of this? Is it creativity? Is it risk? What is it that's stopping people from moving out of incrementalism to the bolder stuff?
I think that the key issue that I observe, at least, comes back to the point about being deliberate. Usually we're deliberate about creating an environment where we can execute flawlessly, which doesn't leave much margin for error, which means people aren't ever going to put big ideas on the table. So it's about calibrating the culture and the environment to the outcome that you're looking for. So if we have a one-size-fits-all culture, guess what? We're going to get one-size-fits-all, fairly low-ceiling levels of creativity around ideas that come forward. So if we create dedicated space, and in the book, one of the things I talk about is creating rehearsal space, where you can try stuff out and it doesn't matter if it goes wrong. And that's more of a mindset than anything, but it's creating an environment where people can legitimately explore in a disciplined way ideas that will probably fail because they're bold. But if they do fail, we're doing it for the right, you know, we've done it with great process. We've done it with very low risk. We've done it with low stakes so that no one gets fired, no one gets hurt. So that's, for me, if we're thinking about leaders as stewards of the organization, stewardship is about prudence, I think, you know, and that's about not taking overt risks or silly risks. But the flip side of prudence also is, if we don't take enough risks, then the future is not going to thank us for it because we're not going to show up there. So it's about creating a deliberate environment where bolder ideas can show up, knowing most will fail. And so we're setting up different metrics, a different culture, making sure all of the time that it has close ties into the main, you know, the mothership, so that it doesn't become this ivory tower. As you know, often you see these innovation labs failing because they have no clear purpose and they're trying to run on the same rules as the rest of the organization. And, you know, they fail for lots of different reasons.
I guess the point you're making here is that there's a tremendous amount known about how to do all of this stuff, but leaders aren't making the choices necessary to make this happen. For example, the exponential organizations playbook has been around for, I don't know now, it's nearly a decade. You know, it's quite clear that all the tools to be able to do this, the methodologies are public, in the public domain, and organizations are picking them up. It's what's driving startups. And we are living in the fourth industrial revolution, where the signals that we need to do these things, that you need to build digital business models, you need to embrace all these disruptive technologies, are all out there. So why are organizations, in your impression, why do you see leaders kind of in denial about this stuff? Why aren't they being deliberate about these choices?
Well, I think some of it is the reality that many leaders inside organizations have never actually led innovation practices or had to do a lot of highly innovative work. They've succeeded on the basis of being really great at creating an environment where incremental innovation can show up, which we need, by the way. We need incremental and we need transformational as well. But when a leader is invited to step into or kind of told on a burning platform, now we need bolder, bigger ideas, often they've never actually been shown how to do it. And it's often usually, you know, by virtue of their seniority, it's assumed that, well, you know, I've done an MBA, I've been to all of the exec ed programs around, there's not much left for me to learn, I think, is the inner dialogue that's going on. And so when they're confronted with it, they actually don't know what to do. And that's hard for a successful leader, perhaps often in the later stages of their career, to first accept and then second to actually act on. And I have to say, it's one of the most refreshing things for me to meet a CEO or a senior person who says, do you know what, I have no idea what to do next. Can you help me, or at least find people who can help me create an environment where the future can show up more successfully? Because I recognize I am going to be a constraint on our current and future success. In fact, I should probably be thinking about, am I the right person for the current season so that the future seasons can show up? There's so much at stake for people to even ask that question usually. Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest breakthroughs I've found in that area is to stop talking about leadership training and just say, take workshops, take formats, take strategic conversations, take forums where executives can lean into conversations and learn during a conversation and set out, if we were to move from A to B, what would need to be true to get to B, and work back from the future and not make it about training, but make it about a strategic conversation that demands that we lean in to learn more. And we do it that way around. And all of that is to save face in many ways, to allow leaders to step into something which otherwise they're having to show tremendous amounts of vulnerability, which they've never had to do before in their careers. So it's a sticky topic, but I think a lot of it does boil down to never done this before, really scared about taking the first step. And I think, you know, one of the things that you and I have to do in our roles is to build confidence in leaders to take that first step and show them a pathway to say, this is possible. This is all figure outable. It's not black box. Here's how to take the first step. Here's the first 90 days. Here's the first year. This is what it could look like.
So most organizations, many organizations spend about, you know, leaders will spend about 95% of their time focused on today, value today, with only about 5% of their time focused on value creation for tomorrow. Whereas the exponential organizations, as you know, are modeled more like 70% of their focus is on today and 30% is on value tomorrow. In your view, do you think part of the issue is that sometimes the stakeholders in that leader's sphere, whether it be their own supervisors or, you know, the boards or whatever, are too focused on measuring the value of quarter by quarter results, and that keeps leaders sort of stuck in the mindset of needing to focus on today? Or what other kind of shifts would have to happen for a leader to step more boldly into a 70-30 split?
Well, I think it depends on industry. How fast is your industry moving? What's the trajectory that it's going to be on in 5 years? As far as we know, you know, it's difficult to predict the future with much accuracy these days. But depending on the speed of change in your, well, not just the speed, but the scope of change as well in your industry, that should help you calibrate as a rule of thumb what the split should be. And actually, I think splitting it into two sometimes is too simplistic. A three-way split can sometimes be better. Big chunk on incremental innovation, a small chunk on exploring radical ideas that may not bear fruit for 3 to 5, 10 years even. And in the middle, you've got a place where the promising ideas that are coming from the future have space to grow and germinate and scale, and then they become part of the mothership, if you like. But the key really is being deliberate around what I would call a golden metric, I think. What's the, you know, we talked earlier about the thing that makes the most difference for these organizations is someone chooses. That's great, but that choice can become eroded over time. We forget why we made the choice. So what I really like about companies like 3M, for example, is they have a governing metric which demands a level of innovation for people to get paid, their bonuses, and everything else behind. So their metric is 30% of revenue needs to come from ideas that didn't exist 4 years ago. That means incremental innovation is not going to be enough. We have to be pursuing a portfolio of ideas, many, so some of which will fail, some of which are scaling, some of which are, you know, incremental. And having something like that means that we have to be accountable. And of course, that metric needs teeth. You can't just duck it every year. It has to be something that's meaningful. When you start to create an environment that's led by a metric like that, that's the sort of thing that gives stakeholders and shareholders more confidence that we're not doing something risky here. We're actually doing something prudent, as we said earlier, which is investing today in the future that we need to inherit. So, it's not something that, there's no equation for this that I'm aware of that, you know, punching some numbers and it tells you the split. You have to figure this out as you go. But that would be a rule of thumb for me, I think.
That makes a lot of sense. Can I ask, what's the role of employee in all of this in terms of their own motivation? I'm thinking, you know, just because you've created the right environment for innovation, for creativity, it doesn't necessarily mean that people are going to step into it and do more creative work, does it?
No, it's a really great point. And I think it's a trap that you can easily fall into. And I was doing some work a few years ago, actually, but John, when I was working with you, we were doing some work with Electronic Arts, Andy Billings. I always get the best job title in the world, Vice President of Profitable Creativity, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I was doing a program out there with Andy, and he introduced me to one of the other speakers on the program, and he was a Hollywood screenwriter. I couldn't wait to get into his session. And anyway, I ended up missing his session, which I was really cross about. Anyway, I had a coffee with him afterwards, and I'm not going to try and do an American accent, even though John wanted me to at the beginning of this show.
Go ahead.
No, because it always fails. And whenever I tell this story, people just laugh. So I'll keep it straight. So anyway, we're sitting there with our coffees, and he leans across and he says, "Elvin, do you want me to tell you the secret to every great Hollywood script?" And I'm like, "I love the science of writing. Of course I do. Tell me. And he says, "It's three words: make me care. If the viewer doesn't care from scene to scene, moment to moment, you've lost them. So the science of the script is that journey of making someone care enough to do something, to lean into the film." And for me, that's the heart of what we're trying to do. Well, with any change, I guess, in a corporate, but particularly with innovation, is can you make someone care enough to do something different? Can you create an environment where people care enough to challenge the status quo? So that, and in a way that the stakes don't feel too high, because usually for someone particularly to put a bolder idea on the table, there's a chance that, one, I'm going to inherit an evening job because there's no time to do this during the day. Two, if this thing fails, that's not great for my career in all kinds of dynamics. So it's just not safe for me to do so. So I think the smart companies understand this and they say, okay, what would need to be true? How do we lower the stakes to a point where innovation is attractive and that you won't lose anything? But then it goes further. And I think what I talk about in the book is this idea of kindred connections. How do you create these three kindred connections between employees and the work that they're doing? And so the first one is purpose. Do I have a kindred connection, a close connection with the fact that we're doing something here that matters? The second is with the work itself, which is we're getting stuff done here that matters. So doing something that matters, getting stuff done, making progress. And the third is the people that are around me, these people get it and they're on it, is the way that I describe it. And when those three are in place, it's much more likely that when people are invited to step into doing something that may feel dangerous, that may feel risky, they'll say, well, it's worth it. I believe in this place enough. I believe in the people that's worth stepping into, even if it goes wrong. And again, it's something you have to be deliberate about. It doesn't just show up. So I think motivation is super, super important. And it's something that's often kind of left to HR to figure out. No, that has to be part of the design of the innovation ecosystem right from the start. Because if people aren't coming up with the ideas, what's the point? It doesn't work.
So you talked just a moment ago about getting the right metrics in place. And I couldn't agree more that most organizations, all the metrics are lagging and they're reinforcing the status quo. And having a metric about leaders investing into the future is very absent in most organizations when you actually break it down. At best, they're kind of time shifting today into the future rather than actually creating new markets and new products. But let's talk about getting the flywheel going because that takes time to make it happen. And you know, you and I remember looked at that survey that IBM commissioned a few years ago about what CEOs most want from employees, and the number one factor was creativity. Then we did our own survey looking at thousands of people in organizations and asked them the question as part of the mindset around innovation, and said, you know, creativity is, I'm paid to be creative in my job. And less than 10% of people actually acknowledge that. There's a huge gap there between what people think they're getting paid to do in terms of being creative, of imagining new futures, and what's expected of them in the organization with what we're talking about here. What's your kind of experience recently in terms of trying to get the flywheel moving about getting more people to be creative?
It's two things for me, I guess. The first is, what outcomes are we pursuing here? And usually the outcomes are numbers, and it's we need to grow by X percent. What we don't do enough of is look at, yeah, but we grew X percent because of, what did we do? What needle did we move for a customer? And when you look at a lot of the research showing what are the most profitable organizations on the planet now and previously, they are the organizations that deeply understood the progress that customers are trying to make in their life in a given context. And our job is to supercharge that progress through history. So one of the examples I like to give, Scott, you'll recognize this, is in the music industry. You rewind 100 years. If you wanted to manage your music, get access to your music, you had to carry around these big wax cylinders that played terrible quality music. Then we switched to vinyl. Then we switched to 8-track. Then we switched to cassette. Then we get to CD, and you know, now we're onto streaming. At each shift, the customers were able to make better progress in their ability to access and manage music. And if you look at Netflix today, they don't call themselves a streaming company. They say, we help people find the best movies. That used to be DVDs. Now it's streaming. You can bet your bottom dollar they're already looking at what's next. The reason for saying all of that is, often the object of our creativity, the focus of our creativity, is not on the thing that matters most. And so many of ideas, I'm sure we're all used to this, the ideas that do make it off the whiteboard often crumble because there's not a strong enough connection to any progress that's going to deliver commercial outcome. So the first one is, what are we innovating for? What is the idea for? Give it some commercial anchor points so that it sticks around longer. Because often what happens is we come up with a great question, someone comes up with an idea, the idea is wrong, and we abandon the question as well. It's like, no, the question is the thing, the progress we're trying to help people move. So that will be the first thing is, what's the progress? Nail the progress. And there's, you know, jobs to be done is a great methodology for looking at that lens through. I think the second is what we were talking about earlier, is lowering the stakes. If you want people to dream bigger, you need to give them the confidence that if I do dream bigger and I put something bigger on the table, that it's going to be in my interests to step forward into that. And I'm not going to be penalized for discovering that we were wrong all along. We all agreed this was the right next idea to pursue. We all learned that it was wrong. I don't want to be the one whose neck is on the block because I learned what we all needed to know. So lowering the stakes through experimentation. I think the third thing I would say is, you know, the flip side to be less zombie is be more human. There's been so much research done, particularly neuroscience in the last few years, around what causes a human being to enter their most creative state. And we pay it lip service in the workplace. And when I see organizations over investing in an environment where people have lower stress, you know, we run brainstorms at a certain time of the day, we make sure people have had enough sleep, we're making sure, you know, all of the things we know to be true, and yet we deny because, well, we haven't got time, we've only got half an hour for the brainstorm. Well, you get what you invest in. And, you know, often we want cordon bleu cooking in microwave timescales is the way that I sometimes describe it. We've got to get real about what it takes for people to come up with genius, and it's not necessarily instantaneous. So designing workplaces where creative work can show up, I think, is a big part of it too.
Who's inspiring you most? What organizations are inspiring you most right now?
It's hard not to point to Netflix. I don't like all of the content they produce by any means, but you look at the mechanics of what they're trying to do behind the scenes and create environments where people genuinely can do their best work, have transparent conversations, be very adult, I think, in the way that work happens, and encouraging people to step into not just the best version of themselves, but what that takes. And that sometimes that means getting over yourself and, you know, ego coming down in the pursuit of doing the best work for the organization. I still really like, I mean, I mentioned them before, 3M. I mean, they're an older company, but they've got a very mature way, a very strategic way about thinking about innovation in ways that have been proven. You know, they've had a blip in recent years, but they're on their way back now. I like Spotify. I like the way that they're always trying to reimagine work. You know, they're one of a few companies recently who have said everyone's working from home from now on. And I know they will do their best to figure out what does a great home work environment look like, because the guy who runs it is on a mission to do something spectacular. So those would be three that spring to mind.
If you're new to the Evolving Leader podcast, please subscribe to us on your favorite platform. We have many more thought-provoking and inspiring guests coming up this season that you won't want to miss. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review. Thanks for listening.
So I'm just curious, you know, you're investing so much in others. What do you do to invest in yourself and make sure that you stay in the right mindset and able to keep going and helping all these organizations to be more innovative?
I think, you know, I've got to take my hat off to here, John, in some respects, because John, for many years, was, and still is in some ways, a mentor to me. And watching how John does his life was a big influence on me. I'm not just saying that because I'm on here and John used to be someone I worked with. That's genuinely true. John's been a tremendous help to me in that.
John, are you paying our guests now?
I couldn't afford him. You've seen his day rates.
I think that, well, the things that I try and do is increasingly not take myself so seriously and think I need to have the right answer. I learned that not that long ago, actually, that people aren't necessarily looking for an answer. They're looking for someone to help them make decisions and ask great questions and be a sparring partner more than anything else, because, you know, who really knows the right answers to any of these questions at the moment? So helping leaders create space to have those conversations and not have to have the right answer is something that I'm allowing myself to kind of relax into more. Mm. I read so much. I probably read too much, and I love it, and so it's easy for me to do. I've got so many books that I haven't read. I decided yesterday, I told my wife, I'm having a reading week. She said, finally. I've been telling you this for years, so I'm going to have a reading week. I guess the other thing is I pray a lot. Seriously, I do. I'm quite a spiritual person. John will tell you that. And I just find so much strength. I get so much strength just from the wisdom in the Bible and praying and just trying to stay centered and recognize that some of the problems that I get invited to come in and try and solve are way bigger than me. And there's just got to be different places to get the wisdom.
Mm. You also have an exercise bike underneath your desk by the looks of it.
Can you tell?
Yeah.
No, I do. It comes out occasionally. I have put it on LinkedIn and people probably assume it's there more often than it is. But occasionally it comes out, yeah.
Can you tell us about the book you're writing, your next book?
I haven't really said too much about it yet. And some of that is there's actually two books. And I'm not sure which one I'm actually going to write as a book and which one is going to be just product that I'm going to sell. I think the book is going to be about in the way that Be Less Zombie is really about, how do you very practically operationalize innovation? How do you get to base one? I talk about turn it on, then turn it up. This is turn it on. The thing that I wanted to write about most but didn't have space for, and the thing that I'm really passionate about, is creativity. How do you actually grab it and do it? How do we finally grasp creativity and switch it on? And again, lots of great books have been written about it, but there's still, for me, there's a gap in a more practical expression of how it shows up day to day. How do you hotwire it in so that people can genuinely have more chance of coming up with collaboratively, coming up the ideas that the world needs? Because for me, that's the issue right now, is the problems are so complex. I don't think we can rely on AI to figure them all out. I think we need to help give people the tools in an environment where truly great ideas can emerge. And I just want to be part of that process. So I'm in deep research mode at the moment, reading a book at the moment about the neuroscience of creativity and just going, oh my goodness, this stuff is so interesting. How do I turn it into a tool? You know, that's the thing for me.
That sounds great.
If you think back to what have been the most difficult situations you found yourself in the last 5 years, where you're in a quite difficult place with, not you personally, but the organization's in a difficult place. They're really struggling. The stakes feel high. Leaders are really feeling, you know, uncertain and maybe a bit fearful. What have you encountered in trying to help organizations do these things where it's become difficult?
I think that the single most important thing that I've learned is leaders need to see a pathway. It comes back to what we were saying earlier. Often leaders haven't done a lot of this stuff and they know they need to do it. And for the years where I used to talk about innovation in more, I guess in more abstract terms, being really honest, I could still see the look in leaders' eyes like, yeah, but what does that actually mean? What am I going to do next? What money am I going to attribute to a project so that something actually happens? And I think I had a breakthrough probably 4 years ago where I was asked to facilitate a meeting with five CEOs of an umbrella company. And they just wanted to talk about how do we do innovation better. And I thought we need something to hook this conversation around. So I just came up with this model just to help make the conversation happen, and actually became the model at the heart of the book. There's another story about how I came up with umpteen models while I was writing the book and then realized, oh my goodness, it's the same model I came out with a couple of years ago. But and it was really looking at, okay, what's the strategy that drives an innovation strategy? And therefore, what needs to be true around process, around resources, capability, culture, and leadership, so that that strategy can take shape. And I'll never forget what happened when I put it up on the screen. What had been a relatively confused conversation before suddenly got focus. People were like, okay, I can do that. I get that. There is at least a framework that we can start putting some planning around. That's the first thing. I think the second thing is, again, something John, you and I were both at a few years ago. Rita McGrath came over from the US, and I think you hosted her for an event in London for some clients, and I was there. And she said this, she just asked a question that just blew my mind. And it was so simple now, it's one of those questions. She said, you just need to ask yourself, what needs to be true in order for X? What do you mean? And then she unpacked it. And I've learned that if you say to people, you know, let's pick a destination in the future, 2030, we need to be in this position. Okay, so what would need to be true in 2029 and 2028 and 2027? Now, of course, you can't predict all of those things, But what it does do is help you see a trajectory that you want to pursue and some things that you would need to put into place now. So when you bring a model together of operationalizing innovation with a trajectory that it needs to follow, suddenly it starts to feel more tangible and doable. And that for me is, if I can help a leader feel more confident to take that first step, to step on the ice and see it's not going to crack, because there's some safety around this, there's some discipline, there's some rigor, I've found that getting to that conversation as quickly as possible is the thing that then unlocks the journey of innovation.
How have you adapted your work and lifestyle around COVID?
Well, it's funny, it hasn't actually changed that much. Of course, being on the other end of a camera when I'm doing leadership development work is one thing. And I'll be honest, I don't enjoy it as anywhere near as much. I'd much rather be in the room, just as you all know, different dynamics, different humanity to the whole thing. But a lot of my work really at the moment is, you know, I'm doing some work at the moment for one of the big power companies. And there's just a lot of desk research and interviewing people and trying to get a sense of what culture is like so I can make recommendations. And then we move on to the next stage. And that's just, it's all done at home. So there hasn't been a huge shift. I think the shift that I'm having to look at more is, how does innovation show up for organizations in a more constrained context? And you probably saw this too. At the beginning of lockdowns around the world, innovation budgets just dried up. I'm seeing they're being switched on again now. But the whole conversation around, well, how do you do this stuff when we can't gather in rooms, where we can't debate stuff, where we can't make prototypes together? That's been more of an issue, I think. But even that, I think that the leap to the digital tools that are available to do a lot of that stuff has just been mind-bogglingly fast and really helpful. So actually, not huge changes, I don't think.
Given the fact that a number of organizations are thinking actively now about becoming more distributed in nature, with less people working in the office, and they've had a year, or maybe they'll have 18 months of practicing using digital tools to prototype and generate innovation. We kind of go forward. What do you think the work of leadership and innovation is going to look like in a couple of years' time? How do you think your role is going to change?
I'd like to think that in some respects, not much will change at one level. Let me qualify that. We were talking earlier about what progress does an organization need to make over its history, you know, in a life cycle. Ultimately, innovation is a kind of a unit of progress that organizations are going to need to make. So organizations talking to me, I think, are still going to be saying, how do you do this thing? How do you keep it switched on? So I think at one level, how it will affect my work, I'm relatively hopeful that innovation is only going to become more important, not less important. I think from a leader's point of view, the determination to finally say, I need to bite the bullet and I need to become a leader who no longer shrinks back from leading more disruptive innovation. I need to study it. I need to make that the new skill that I develop in my life. Because if you look back at I was talking to a guy called, you know, Raphael Orta, who used to be at eBay and has moved on to different places. He's in the book. And he says, you know, you look around on the board of most organizations, the collective capabilities and the experience that got them to today are not the ones that are going to get us to tomorrow. And yet they're still there. No one's really leaning into understanding how to design digital business models. No one's really learning into understanding what some of these exponential technologies actually mean to our organization, so that then we can use that meaning to trigger innovation in a meaningful way. So for me, there has to be a choice by leaders to step into deliberately pursuing managing uncertainty, really trying to supercharge creativity, and making it happen appropriately across an organization. And don't hear me wrong here. It's not what I'm not saying is everybody needs to become a moonshot factory. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, as Scott said earlier, there needs to be 10-15% at least of the organization showing up in a different guise so that bigger ideas can come forward. What does that require of me as a leader? What's my ripple effect today? And what impact does that have on people's willingness to step forward? What does it need to be? Otherwise, I'm a potential constraint on the future. I'm potentially a nail in the coffin of the future of this organization. So some of it is around deep self-reflection and a choice about who do I want to become in service of this organization becoming something truly great.
I love that.
Well, Elvin, it's wonderful to catch up with you. Congratulations on your continued success with Be Less Zombie. It's doing extremely well, deservedly so. We're really grateful to have time with you. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Elvin. It's been a pleasure.
No, it's been great. Thank you ever so much for having me on.
Well, we hope you enjoyed these brilliant insights from Elvin as much as we did. And until next time, remember, the world is evolving. Are you?